All right, welcome to the Retro Game Club Podcast, Season 3, Episode 29, which is also Episode 101. I am Rob, and with me is someone else who just keeps coming up with personal projects to do, so he actually has no free time, just like myself, Hugh.
That's right, yeah. I'm actually working on a programming article that serves no purpose to anyone at all, but I will probably post it in a week or two.
So you keep saying stuff like that, but then your articles keep getting referenced in other people's posts. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I know. Well, I mean, if solving collision detection for ALF on the Sega Master System is a very important thing for mankind to develop.
Yeah.
I guess I contributed in some tiny, tiny, tiny way.
Yeah. So what else have you been up to? What are your crazy projects or anything retro you've been doing?
Well, you know, I saw that Quake was announced. It's been so long since we recorded a proper episode. We haven't talked about the Quake remake.
Yeah.
The surprise Quake drop. And I was going to just order the download version, but then I saw Unlimited Run Games was going to do a physical printing. And it's like, well, I've waited a long time to play Quake again. I did actually beat Quake back in the day. Mm-hmm. Not on the highest difficulty, I'm sure. So I ended up pre-ordering it for whatever, Switch and PlayStation 4, because I'm a crazy person like that.
So when you first played Quake, did you have like the original Voodoo card or anything like that?
I had a diamond card, I think.
Was it 3D? Were those 3D by then?
I don't know. It was like Diamond S.
The Verge 3D, maybe?
No, that couldn't be right, because this came out in 19... So, I actually bought Quake when it was new. I bought it, like, brand new. Like, 1996, I bought it. And I had a pretty generic video card. I mean, a decent one, but it was, you know, whatever was mid-tier like the 1995.
Like the Millennium or the Mystique or something like that. The Stealth,
that sounds like it, yeah. That was Diamond Stealth, a video card?
I'm pretty sure. Or yeah. We're mixing up two. Maybe it was the ATI Stealth. It was like Diamond S3.
Oh, maybe I'm thinking of Diamond Stealth SE.
Okay.
Maybe that's the card I'm thinking of?
With like 2 MB of RAM, something like that.
Something like that, yeah. I have to see what year it was made. Oh, the chip says S3 right on the chip. It's called the SE, but it has the letters S3 on it. Of course, S3 means something completely different in computing terms now.
Yeah.
But it was 32-bit, 1 meg EDO RAM. This is probably the card I had.
I've installed many of those.
It feels like the card I had. I just have to confirm. Like, if I look it up, and it says it came out like 1997... No, it came out 1995. Came out February 1995. So this is almost certainly the card I had, the Diamond Stealth SE. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you were doing mostly software 3D with that one, I think.
Yeah, and I thought, you know, Quake played fine.
Yeah.
I really didn't think it was a bad experience. And then Quake is a game that's been kind of sort of notoriously hard to like emulate, and there aren't really any good ports of it. So I really probably haven't played it since. I really bet I haven't played it since 1996.
Nice. Oh. I'm sure it's going to be a much upgraded experience with better controls and probably 4K graphics possible.
Yeah. Yeah, I just want, if it works, I'm not going to complain. So I just want the thing to work. Mm-hmm. So I don't know when I'm going to get it. I mean, I've waited since 1996 to play it again. I'll probably have to play it on easy mode now because my reflexes have kind of turned to garbage. At least they're not 1996 quality anymore.
I wonder if you could have the equivalent of a LAN party, like have everyone bring their PS4s over and it only works over a local area network.
Yeah, I've been to Quake LAN parties.
It's a good time.
Yeah, it was like a combination. Well, I've been to more than one, but the one that most stands out was a combination like housewarming party / Quake LAN party.
Nice. Yeah, I actually had a LAN like that set up where it was a Pentium 233 MMX, and then my SGI O2 machine, and then an iMac. Oh man, there is one more computer on there. I forget what it was, but they all happened. The one game they all ran was Quake. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Well, if you make it to Midwest Gaming Classic, they usually have a Quake room.
Nice. Oh yeah, that's not too far away, is it?
It's not too far away. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they sent an email out about, you know, that they still don't know what the deal's going to be yet, because, you know, they have to work with the city of Milwaukee, and the city of Milwaukee may mandate, you know, certain restrictions or something, right? Mm-hmm. I would say that Midwest Gaming Classic sends an announcement out, and it says something like, city of Milwaukee says you have to have a vaccine to get in. Do not take it out on the Midwest Gaming Classic people if for some reason that upsets you. I don't know why it does. But if you're one of those people who gets upset by this, don't take it out. Midwest Gaming Classic is not trying to install a microchip in you, okay?
And if it was, it would be retro, so it would be this giant 6502 chip. Yeah.
It would be as big as my Diamond Stealth card.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's that, and yeah, just don't beat up the Midwest Gaming Classic, guys. You can tell in the tone of their email that they are very frustrated with the feedback they're getting from people.
Yeah. This weekend is also the Vintage Computer Federation Midwest in Chicago. I'm going to be missing that one. Yeah. Maybe you should stop by that for me.
Chicago. What was it called?
It's like VFC, VCF. It's,
VC. I'm getting a lot of bad autocomplete stuff for that.
It's the Vintage Computer something Chicago, Midwest.
I see the 2016. Oh, here we go. Vintage Computer Festival Midwest.
There you go.
By order of DuPage County. It is at Waterford Banquets in Elmhurst, Illinois. Yeah, this weekend. Huh. And their site is definitely very retro.
It's a cool thing. I've only seen videos from it. I've always wanted to go, and I really wanted to try this year, but it just didn't work out. But they always, you know, have tons of cool setups and of obviously vintage computers and some games on those computers. But there's also a big area with where people just bring their vintage stuff to sell on consignment. Mm-hmm. And there's also free stuff. And I heard you get a lot of great deals there. So if you're in the Chicago area, and I get this mixed in time, definitely go.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So I've been to a retro video game event at the same venue. I've been to one in Elmhurst before, but it was not this festival. Okay, well, yeah, go ahead, wear a mask. Whatever rules they set up, it might be their rules, it might be Elmhurst rules, it might be Illinois rules. Don't argue with them, whatever their rules are.
Yeah, just everyone be cool.
Yeah. And then I keep mentioning we're not sponsored by Target, but as a follow-up to a previous item, I've gone to Target every weekend, as I've been doing for most of my adult life. And they are absolutely overflowing with Skyward Sword, Joy-Cons, and Amiibos.
So, the scalpers did not win.
Yeah, they might have had some short-term wins, but right now they are all over the place. And this is also why I did not pre-order the Switch OLED, because I figure it'll come out, I'll see some reviews, and then I'll walk into Target and just buy one if it sounds like a good deal.
Yeah, yeah. I'm pretty sure the Switch OLED after this holiday season will just be the Switch. Like, why would you buy the other one? Yeah, why would they even have it?
Right. How about you? What have you been up to?
Oh, man. Like you said, it's been a while since we recorded a real episode. And let's see, I swung into our friends at Nerd Out in Oak Park, Michigan, and I picked up two video games, actually. I got this California Games 2600 in the box. Pretty mint. Looks really good. I got this next one just because it's really nostalgic for me. I got Kangaroo boxed, pretty mint for 2600. And yeah, these looks really, really, really good. Love that store, and I love finding video games there, but few impulse buys. I have no idea why I did this, but If you go to Jansen, J-A-S-E-N-S, customs.com, this guy makes cases for your CPS2 motherboard, like PC board, which is like Street Fighter 2, Darkstalkers, stuff like that for the arcade. And makes it so it has HDMI and other cool ports like that. And I have a multi CPS2 board. And so for no reason at all, I'm going to put it in one of these things. I think this is the last time he was taking orders for them, but it just seemed like such a cool, unique thing. Even if I don't use it, I'll sell it to someone who will really appreciate it. And as of today, I finally finished building my Mr. FPGA console thing. And man, that thing's cool. Wow. It in many ways, it's cooler than the analog stuff. I highly recommend anyone playing retro video games to build one of these things, or even go on Etsy and you can like buy them pre-built. So I'll wait till I play around with it a bit more. I was having some problems with CD games. Well, Sega CD was working, but TurboGrafx wasn't. But like I said in the intro, so many little projects that just we spend all our time doing that instead of playing actual video games. But yeah, other than that, I just wanted to mention our new bumper music again. I don't feel like I gave it it's due on our last episode, just because it was one of the things that I forgot to kind of study in the notes beforehand. But yeah, it's two songs. The first one is from Inverse Phase. That is kind of a cover of an old song that I wrote that used to be our bumper music. The second one is Raftronaut with an original song. So the Inverse Phase one is kind of Game Boy sound effects, and the Raftronaut one is more NES sounds. We love them both. We'll probably swap them every once in a while, which one's at the beginning, which one's at the end. It's kind of hard to decide which one we'd want. And yeah, just wanted to thank those two artists again, and Zach for commissioning those for us. And those will always be linked in our show notes, like everything else we talk about. But
Are they on that Linktree page?
They're at the bottom of our notes right now. Maybe we'll see if Zach wants to add those to Linktree. I don't know if it's proper to link to other people's stuff from Linktree, but we could kind of do what we want.
I don't know the Linktree protocol at all.
Neither do I.
I don't think they're going to ban us. I mean, maybe someone will think we're weird or something. We're not using Linktree as...
They'll just...
Who made that joke, Linktree? I don't know who's the creator of it. decided we shouldn't use it that way. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, I guess we should dive into some news that's been sitting in our notes for weeks now.
Yeah, yeah, let's see. Why does the Game Boy Pocket produce a blue line on power off?
The answer is electricity. And the big part of this story is that this is on stackexchange.com, which is a very popular programming and server ask questions, get answers website. They have a retro computing section now in it. That's the real story here. But someone gives a real answer in this article. So if you really want to know why when you turn off your Game Boy, there's a black line, you could go and find out.
How to build your own Atari cloud. So this is more about running like Kubernetes or something?
Mm-hmm. On Raspberry Pis.
On a Raspberry Pi to launch Atari emulators. So you can have on-demand cloud Atari emulation if playing Atari games on the cloud is something you... I mean, it's a cool project. This fits into like the cool but useless project idea.
Yeah, like if you want to teach yourself Kubernetes, this is a great little project.
It's very good for that, absolutely, yeah.
And yeah, it looks like it uses the VNC protocol, which, man, I can't believe people... Do people still use it other than retro projects? I don't think so.
Yeah, I've used it when I do stuff on my Raspberry Pi, but that's about it.
Mm-hmm.
It's very good for that. I was using it for... What? Oh, this was 10 years ago. It was a company that was, I was working at a company that was trying to move to, well, they were trying to move to what the, they were being cheap, but selling it like a benefit. So they had a policy called bring your own computer.
Mm-hmm.
And really the policy should have been called, we don't want to pay for computers.
Yeah.
And yeah, there's a lot of like VNC and Citrix stuff to get into the environment. You had a couple ways to do it. As a joke, I bought an Xbox at a yard sale for $5. This is when the whatever Xbox 2 or whatever it was called was out. And hacked that to run Citrix so I could actually do work on the Xbox.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Did they have any comments about that?
No. I was expecting a little better reaction, but no.
That's funny.
See, so posted in the past couple weeks, there's an article. It's just a, this is not news. It's a tech article that I liked, comparing the 286 to the 386 SX and explaining why the 386 SX, was able to kill the 286 essentially. And it mostly comes down to Windows, and it explains on a technical level why the 386 SX, even though it had some downsides versus the 286, was a really good chip to run Windows, but you couldn't run Windows on the 286.
Yeah. And, I had a few friends that had 386 DXs back then, and I had a 386 SX, and I just didn't know why their computers were running circles around mine.
Yeah. You would think, you know, SX, it's like further down the alphabet, so it would be better.
Yeah, not so much.
No.
Yeah, some marketing there.
you put this one. Polymega's released. Jeez, have we ever talked about the Polymega? Have people been talking about the Polymega since like 1998? You tell me.
I feel like it was like an episode zero or something. We've been talking about it.
Yeah, I feel like I could find articles on like the Google newspaper archive from like the 1930s talking about the Polymega. That's how long it feels like I've been hearing that the Polymega is coming.
Yeah, like it's like
it's now
the Rosetta
really,
Stone.
Really, really coming. Like, it's actually going to be a thing you can buy.
It's out. So I think you could get it now. And
it says September 12th.
There you go. So in a few days, yeah. So they sent them out. And yeah, you know, these things were built in Myanmar, which had a lot of civil unrest and the coronavirus. And, you know, they moved this thing from FPGA to just more like, well, Libretro probably, but you know, they did so much good for the Saturn emulation that I don't think they get enough credit for. You know, what I kind of write in the notes here is that, you know, it doesn't feel like a scammy Atari or Intellivision type thing, but mm-hmm. also this thing would have been a lot more cool and useful in 2017 when it was announced.
Yeah. I mean, again, it's software emulation, which, you know, works pretty well on your PC. I don't think there's anything wrong with it. I don't know. Like, what's the advantage to this versus, I guess you can use physical media.
Yeah, you could use physical media and you could dump your ROMs from the physical media, but you can't just like plug in a USB stick and have all the ROMs on there. Like, you kind of already have to own it. So that's even cool. You know, you could stick like your TurboGrafx, you know, Hue cards in it. You could stick your CD games in it and put it to the SSD drive that's inside of it, so it will load faster if you want. It does not support EverDrives, but what I think two things it does really well. The first is something that the Mister has, which is very fast native, well, almost native controller ports. And a USB bus to accommodate that, so you'll get like almost perfect latency, between the controller and the system. And also, the very cool thing that I really haven't seen anywhere else is a cool patch system. So somehow it could download IPS patches and apply them to your ROMs, and also keep different versions. So if you want to play, you know, the original unpatched version, it's there also. So I thought that was a really cool touch, and I really haven't seen that anywhere else. But again, it's not 2017. There's so many other things competing with this thing that's $400.
Now, but maybe you can actually buy it, which is the selling point it has over the analog.
True, yeah. But also, you could just get a Mister for $100 less.
Yeah, depends how much it depends how much that $100 is worth. You know, you from a time standpoint. Like, I suspect your Mister, you probably still have more than $100 worth of trying to get controllers to work.
Oh, totally. Like, I got an Xbox controller to work with it, but that's just phase one. I want real controllers to work with it before I'm done with it. So, yeah, you are right.
All right, so we're going to move on to a segment of homebrew, ROM hacks, and emulation. And bad title, but it says it's now possible to play early 90s CD-ROM games in ScumVM, which, of course, it's always been possible to do. This is actually an article about how Macromedia Director is now supported in ScumVM, which means a lot of games built in Macromedia Director are now playable. Many of these are games you would not want to play. I'm not going to make the list. But it's still cool to see. I mean, this is a lot of stuff that people have not been able to play for a very long time.
Macromedia Director was a garbage programming language. Let's just get that out there. What else? Oh, RetroArch 1.9.9 is out. And the big deal with this is that it supports AMD's Fidelity FX, FSR. So what all that nonsense I said is that AMD released, well, I guess it's, I don't know if it's like with the driver update or whatever, but with pretty much any graphics card, you can now kind of upscale your games you play. And so they look like they are rendered at a much higher rate than they were. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't take too much more processing power from your graphics card. Just a real ingenious thing they've done. And they use some East images here.
And E7, yeah.
Yeah, looks sharper. So pretty cool. So upgrade your RetroArch. What else? another Hackaday article. Someone hacked Mega Man 4 to get rid of the power shot. So, well, is it the power shot or the charge shot? I forget what people call it in that.
But yeah, they call it the charge shot in this article.
Okay, yeah. So that was the big difference between, you know, Mega Man 3 and Mega Man 4. And it annoyed a lot of people. And so they even updated it where the bad robots you shoot aren't really sponge bullets anymore. So since you don't have the charge shot, you know, that would make it even worse. So kind of leveled the game out a bit too. So might be worth a try.
I'm going to go through a few of these here. GS Adventure, Atari 2600 Adventure port for the Apple II GS. Looks very cool. The company that calls themselves Atari typically does not send a lot of takedown letters, so I think this might stick around, but it also might not, so this would be something you might want to grab before it goes away. It looks pretty, like a pretty perfect replica.
Yeah, it looks like the source is on GitHub, too.
It is, yeah. Yeah, so grab that just in case. Unsubstantiated rumor that the Switch might get Game Boy and Game Boy Color titles.
But it's gonna, like, even if this rumor is wrong, like, we all know that's coming. Like, there's no world where they don't do that, right?
Yeah, there is. Yeah, I think so.
I don't know. Didn't they bring Game Boy titles to the Wii, like the virtual store?
And the 3DS. You can get, like, Oracle of Ages, Oracle of Seasons on 3DS.
Yeah, I feel like this, it's always been inevitable, but That's just my gut feeling.
What else here? Game Boy Productivity Suite. So this is a Kickstarter for a set of productivity tools that you can run on the Game Boy. It is not a joke, despite how much it sounds like one. But it's like calculator, notepad, and clock apps for the Game Boy. And I went ahead and backed this. because I'm assuming this is actually a real project. The prices are in Canadian, so it was actually cheaper than I thought. At first, I thought, oh, I don't know if I want to spend that much. And then I realized, oh, wait, I can take like 20% off the price.
Nice. Do you get, when you back it, do you get a physical cart?
If you back it for 45 Canadian or more.
Okay.
That gets you the physical 4-in-1 suite, the physical calculator app, and for an extra dollar, you get an add-on of some kind. You have a yet-to-be-announced add-on thing.
Nice. It's a funny project.
Yeah, I mean, why not? You know, the price wasn't that bad, and I don't know, maybe I'll actually use, maybe I'll see if it works on my Game Boy Micro.
Yeah.
Use that as a calculator as opposed to the one on my phone. All right. Next section. I just realized we've got a bunch of stuff, so I'm going to power through a couple of these here. Next section, Doom running on things. We got two here. We got Doom running on an office desk phone and Doom running within the game, Age of Empires.
Yeah, yeah. So the desk phone one pretty much says like these phones are ARM 7, you know, with 4 gig machines. So they're like, they're going to run a lot more than Doom pretty soon.
Yeah. And then, and they have a color screen that is supposed to be to like manage contacts or whatever.
Yeah. The Age of Empire one is crazy because it's an actual new like isometric Doom. It's like a whole new game. It's really like nothing I've really ever seen before. So definitely check that on.
Not seen Office. So a true story here. When I was negotiating to come over to the company that I work at right now, my only demand was I do not want a desk phone under any circumstances.
What did they say?
They said, that's fine. And now and then it comes up. Someone's like, hey, I tried to look you up to call you and you don't have a number. I said, that's right, because I don't want you to call me. Like, you have email, you have instant message. That's two ways. You walk over to my desk, that's three ways.
Yeah.
I don't want the call.
Yeah. Don't answer my desk phone, so I don't blame you.
I mean, there was also salary and other stuff. I specifically said, I don't ever want a desk phone.
And you also have your own cell phone if you actually had to make a call. So,
yeah, there's the desk phone serves no purpose. I'm literally saving the company money.
Yeah,
it's like one less line they have to pay for, and I don't have to deal with. I spent years. I had a desk phone at another job where some deadbeat gave that number out to a debt collector.
Oh man,
that phone rang all the time. I still remember the person's name that they were calling for. I won't say it on the show. And they just would not believe my explanation that this deadbeat gave them a fake phone number.
That is amazing.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. All right, and then last section, odd or interesting things. We got an article about zero tolerance for the Genesis being a impressive technical feat. Game of Life, Super Mario Edition. Original art assets found on some magneto optical discs. It sounds like a hard for gaming link.
It is. It is.
It is. Okay.
Yeah.
And the Nintendo and Super Nintendo console designer Lance Barr leaves Nintendo after 39 years.
Yeah. Out of all those, I just want to mention the hard for games one. They were able to get all this data off these optical zip disks, and a lot of it are EPS files. So they are at full resolution even today. So very cool stuff. So if you like Turok and South Park art from Nintendo 64.
This is pretty good. And then the last thing I want to give a shout out, Polygon did a feature in the past week called Retro Gaming Today, which I thought was a new daily column, but it's not. And it's like 7 or 8 just retro gaming articles all in a row.
Yeah, so go in our show notes, check it out. There's a lot of cool stuff there. Just not enough time to go through it on the actual podcast. But everything from Mr. Stuff to pinball to, lots of stuff. Game Boy Advance SP news. And we have an already dated topic when we did our 100th episode. The Super Nintendo turned 30.
Yeah. Yeah. 30 in America, I guess that would be, right?
Yeah, yes.
Japan for at least a year, I think.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, it was a limited release August 23rd, 1991. According to Wikipedia, it was actually released, today, September 9th, 1991. So, I guess that's from an article in the New York Times, which again, maybe that's when the New York Times heard it was released. Who knows? But
Yeah, New York Times is not a good source for breaking video game news.
No.
Because even Wikipedia, it says August 23rd, 1991. Where are you getting this September 9th from?
Wikipedia.
No, I'm looking at Wikipedia. It says August 23rd, 1991.
Keep reading.
Oh, it has two dates?
Yeah.
Well, that's confusing.
Exactly, yeah. But it was released for $199. You know, it's the same chip that the Apple II GS has at 3.5 megahertz, 15-bit color, up to 256 color, depending on what modes you're in. And how do you explain a mode to a non-programmer? There's 8 different modes.
Oh, I probably should have prepped for that because I don't actually have an explanation.
it's kind of hard to explain, but I guess it just puts the video card in a different mode, I guess. So it could use either a higher def or, you know, the mode 7 where it can
controls the number of layers. Like mode 0, 4 layers, each with 4 color palettes. Mode 1, 3 layers with 16 color palettes.
I'm not gonna. A layer those. Would be like a background, pretty much?
Background, yeah. I actually read an article explaining how layers work on the Genesis.
Okay.
But yeah, most of these are 2 or 3 layers. Sorry, I'm losing my voice. I don't have COVID. I've just been on a lot of conference calls today. And then mode 7, which is one layer of 128 by 128 tiles, which is the only one that you can rotate and scale using matrix transformation, something I have not done since college.
It sounds like a lot of math.
Mm-hmm.
So what are your memories and thoughts about the release, specifically the release? Like, I just want to say, like, we're not going like in depth, you know, about the whole history of the SNES. I'm sure a billion other retro video game podcasts out there did that. We're just talking about, you know, what we remember of it.
Well, so it's an interesting one for me because when I first saw the Super Nintendo, I was sort of not impressed with it. Mm-hmm. I was a big Genesis fan, and I thought the Genesis was just like the more, for lack of a better term, grown-up system. And just the Super Nintendo came across as kind of like a kiddie system. I realized it launched with like SimCity, but like the initial lineup, I was like, yeah, I don't know if this is for me. Maybe I've outgrown Nintendo. Mm-hmm. Clearly, I have not. It wasn't until I was working at the game store and we started getting bundles with Super Mario All-Stars and Link to the Past that I bought one.
That's a great bundle, yeah.
It is, yeah, yeah. I still have the box for it somewhere back here.
Super Mario All-Stars, I keep saying this, is one of the best, I guess, deals in all of video game history.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so to get Link to the Past, too.
Yeah, you have 3 good Mario games and one that is really just a ROM hack of the first game with added difficulty.
And some of them didn't. There was also a cart that also came with Super Mario World on it as well, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't have that one. But this bundle, what it was is that Nintendo was doing a bunch of bundles where it's like a bundle with Link to the Past or a bundle with Super Mario World or a bundle with Donkey Kong Country, I think was later.
Mm-hmm.
Super Metroid was never one of these bundles. They were all games that were like, you know, 1 or 2 years old at that point. And then just kind of out of nowhere, they tacked on Super Mario All-Stars to that bundle also.
Just what a great deal. Yeah.
Yeah. And really, I still like Zelda a lot, so I wanted to get Link to the Past. Mm-hmm. And then I would just say as the 16-bit war progressed, like, it became very clear that Sega was more interested in trying to build like new gimmicky hardware accessories, where Nintendo was focused on trying to make really good games. Like, Nintendo wasn't trying to make the Nintendo 64 add-ons. They were just trying to make good games.
Yeah. And if I remember right, Donkey Kong's Country for that Christmas season outsold the Sega Saturn and all its games combined.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure. Just because I worked that year.
It seemed like a great game.
Yeah. And for me, like, the real turning point was, like, Mortal Kombat 2. The Super Nintendo port of Mortal Kombat 2 is just a lot better than the Genesis one. I don't think it's even close. And then, like, Super Metroid was another big influence and kind of changed my opinion. Because, like, Super Metroid is better than... I'll go ahead and say, I think Super Metroid is better than every single side-scrolling game on the Genesis.
I'll go with that, yeah.
And, you know, as I got older and got more into RPGs, like, the Super Nintendo was easily the best 16-bit system for RPGs in the U.S., for sure. Someone might want to argue that the PC Engine CD was better overall. In the U.S., it doesn't really do us any good, though.
Yeah.
But, like, I listed, like, Chrono Trigger, Final Fantasy VI, Mario RPG, and the Super Nintendo Shadowrun are four of the best RPGs of the entire 16-bit generation. It's kind of weird because, like, the next four Nintendo systems combined, I think, have 10 RPGs between all of them. The N64, GameCube, Wii, Wii U. I'll spot them 20 between all four systems.
That's so strange.
Yeah, almost nothing. Earthbound does not make the top five RPGs for me, even on the Super Nintendo, but I know a lot of people love that game. Mm-hmm. So it's really it. Like, it started off, I kind of thought of it as being a kid's system. And I guess I was wrong. You know, over time, it really grew into the best 16-bit system.
Yeah, you know, and in its defense, it did come with a six-button controller before, you know, other systems really did. So mm-hmm. kind of made it a good fighting system, you know. Yeah, I have this vivid memory of playing a Super Nintendo with ActRaiser at the Nintendo World Championship in Detroit on March 29th, 1990. Now, mm-hmm. I know the timeline doesn't totally add up. You know, the ActRaiser would have had to be, you know, a very early build. You know, the Super Famicom was almost out. So, you know, it was in this kiosk machine, so I didn't see the actual system. So, very strange memory there. But I remember being pretty impressed, but I had a TurboGrafx 16 CD, and then I had a Duo as well, and I had an NES, so I didn't feel like I needed the Super Nintendo. I eventually bought one in 1993. I got a Link to the Past, and I think I bought F-Zero with it. I forget if it came with it or not, but I just really loved that game at my buddy's house, and I just wanted to be able to play F-Zero, you know, by myself. And, eventually, I think I bought all these other games used, Earthworm Jim, TMNT, you know, Super Mario All-Stars, Street Fighter 2, and then Super Star Wars and Super Empire Strikes Back, which I think all of those are fantastic games. Definitely Super Star Wars, I think. You know, Star Wars isn't really known for having the best games, mm-hmm. But I think those two hold up really well. And then in that list, you could see I missed a lot of, you know, the games people really love, like Super Metroid and Mario Kart, and I just didn't have them. You know, I knew they existed, but I was never exposed to them, and I was also really into PC gaming at the time, and like I said, I had these other systems as well, so I just didn't really need to spend money that I didn't have on these other games, you know, but I don't know. I think it's my third favorite 16-bit system behind the TurboGrafx and the Genesis. That doesn't mean I don't like it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it kind of depends what you play, right?
Exactly. Like I think in my notes here, you know, I think really my final thoughts on it are that the Super Nintendo has the best games of that era. You know, the Super Metroids of the world. But, and, you know, Link to the Past and stuff like that. And I really do think that F-Zero is still today. It's just a fantastic game. But the TurboGrafx 16 had more great games. You know, it just had a variety of games that I just love to play. None of them, you know, beat these top-tier games, you know, the very few that the Super Nintendo had. but it just had so many other very, very, very good games. And the Genesis, to me, back then was mostly a sports system.
Yeah. Well, exactly. Sonic. If you were into sports, like if Madden games are mostly what you play, which is fine, go ahead, play nothing but Madden games. Genesis was definitely better for Madden games than the Super Nintendo.
Yeah, TurboGrafx-16, you know, the sports games on that are almost laughable compared to the Genesis. Well,
yes, you have one Madden game and you needed the CD player for it, and it's not very good.
I haven't even played that one. That's funny. Yeah. But yeah, any final thoughts on that? You said you worked some Christmas seasons with the Super Nintendo.
Yeah.
Any memories on that?
Pretty much until the end, you know. The last big release I remember was Super Mario RPG. I left the store shortly after Super Mario RPG was released. So it's like the last really big game. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I remember Super Metroid launch and Donkey Kong Country. And of course, the two different Mortal Mondays are the ones that stand out the most.
So would people line up outside of your store and then you would open up the gates? No.
No one ever did that. We never opened at midnight. Never had people lined up outside the store. Windows 95 launch was the closest to... We might have had like one person waiting to get Windows 95 outside the store. That was a big... Windows 95 was probably... In terms of like dollars I've handled in my life, Windows 95 launch is probably number one.
Wow. That's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, everybody wanted Windows 95 that had a PC. Everybody. And it was $100, right? So like you can imagine like when... Sony PlayStation launched. I mean, that was, you know, we got a dozen PlayStations and we sold them, but we got like, you know, 100 copies of Windows 95 full version and 100 of upgrades. And if I do the math on that, that's an awful lot of cash.
Yeah. Yeah. No kidding. Yeah.
I'm sure I handled more than my annual salary in cash the day Windows 95 came out, easily.
That's insane. Well, it made Bill the richest man in the world for a long time.
Yes. And you see how it all turned out for him in the end.
Yeah. All right. I guess we got some game clubs. I guess we played some games over the past few weeks, huh?
Yeah, I guess we did.
I want to go with yours first.
Yeah, I did Joust, which is, you know, the classic... I don't know if it's a co-op or competitive game. I guess you can play it either way. You can play where you're trying to help the other player or where you're trying to kill them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a pretty simple combat game, right? You're on these ostriches, I guess, that can actually fly. And you're mostly fighting the computer opponents. Again, you can fight your friend as well. If you're on a free play machine, that's really the kind of the most fun way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And whoever, it's basically you're ramming into... Or trying to land on the other your opponents, and whoever is higher, whoever's spear is higher wins the joust. And then your opponent turns into an egg for reasons that then you have to collect, or else it hatches into a stronger version of the enemy you killed.
Like you do, yeah.
Yeah. And if you take too long, then a pterodactyl comes to kill you, and if you're very, very good, you can kill the pterodactyl.
Yeah, and I think that's what is called a joust. Either if you get the same vertical pixel and you hit the other person's lance and it makes that sound, or you get the pterodactyl in the mouth, right?
Yeah, you gotta while his mouth is open. So it's very
not
specific.
Easy.
You can't. Yeah, if his mouth is closed, you can't kill him. And the level, the map changes as the game progresses, right? Like parts of the level start to disappear over time.
Oh, yeah, you have a lava element, don't you?
Yeah. Which, actually, the lava, you would think it makes the game harder. It actually kind of makes it easier, because now when you kill your opponents, there's a good chance the egg will land in the lava.
Mm-hmm.
Which, I guess, reduces your score, but makes the game easier, I think.
What ports did you play?
I mostly played the NES version, which is, I think, a very good port.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, very good. And then I tried the 2600 version, and that thing is just, it's nuts. It's so incredibly fast. Like, it's definitely Joust, but it kind of plays like turbo speed Joust, if that's a thing. I described it here in my notes as completely insane.
I didn't find it that way. That's so strange.
Yeah, I just found the controls and everything just be wild. Now, I played it on Stella. I don't know if that makes a difference. I have a physical copy of it for 2600, but I did not play it on a 2600 because I don't have one hooked up right now.
I didn't find it that fast. Yeah, I'll have to go back. This time I did play it on 2600, but I played 7800, 2600, and NES all on the analog NT. It has, you know, cores for Atari stuff. And I also tried the, in MAME, I tried the arcade version, and I thought the 2600 was one of my favorite ports of it. I think I actually like the arcade version the least out of all of them.
Okay.
I mean, it has, you know, kind of better graphics, but all of them really have, you know, really good animation and really good play mechanics. So yeah, I really enjoyed playing that one. You have notes on a sequel?
Oh yeah, there was a on the Atari Jaguar, they were making a 3D sequel called Dactyl Joust. There's like one video that's like 30 seconds long of it you can find on the internet.
Interesting.
Yeah, this is like if Hardcore Games could find a prototype or anything on this, that would be my favorite episode of their show ever. it looks amazing. Maybe not amazingly good. It just looks like quite an incredible feat.
You know they're making a Joust movie, right?
Yeah, are they really though?
Yeah, I think it's. Last I heard, it was still greenlit. Which, watching people on the big screen riding ostriches actually jousting each other,
so when
sounds was, hilarious.
When was Joust the movie announced?
Probably like 2018, I want to say.
No,
earlier than that.
Yeah.
When?
2007.
Oh, wow.
So at this point, I think unlikely we're going to get it. Yeah, posted 14 years ago. So
wow.
I have to
now go, is the time to strike.
I have to go to archive.org to read the original press release on it.
That's funny. Well, I mean, now is the time to strike for retro stuff. It's hip.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, someone optioned it, never made it, and it's just going to sit out there and rot forever.
It's probably for the better.
I'm going to web archive here. New Hollywood company bringing Joust to the big screen. Yes, you read that right. Joust is going to be a movie. Producers Christine Peters and Michael Sorenzi. Christine Peters worked on Area 51, How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days, and Michael Sorenzi worked on Blackout and Blackwater Transit. I see a theme there. Joust is an arcade game that's as old as Pac-Man and has global awareness. We took one element of the game and the brand itself and built a whole new world around it. They describe it as Gladiator meets Mad Max. It is set 25 years in the future, which is almost now.
That is amazing, yeah.
And includes a Las Vegas suspended in midair. Do you think we're a couple years away from Las Vegas suspended in midair?
I was just about to say, would you rather have COVID be the reality or Mad Max ostrich joust? I think I would take the latter.
I think I got a better chance, yeah. they also want to launch it with a new graphic novel being written by Stephen Elliott Altman. Is that someone famous in the comic book world?
Oh, wait. I'm looking up.
Joust. It's been given the fast track and should be wrapped up by June 2008. Several A-list directors have already expressed interest in helming it. That means they don't have a director. There you go.
Let's see. I don't see a Joust graphic novel.
No, of course you don't, because none of this happened.
Yes. I thought at least a graphic novel would happen. Doesn't take as many people as a movie, but
nothing happened. Nothing. I'm seeing if any of these people have made anything since 2000. And so let's see the first one here, Christine Peters. Last film, How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days. According to IMDb.
Wow.
Have not checked. I don't know. Maybe she left the industry or caught COVID or something. And Michael Sorenzi, his last credit is Blackwater Transit from 2009. So it must have been a movie he was working on at the time this article was written, because this came out 2 years later. So, according to IMDb, he has also not done anything. So I guess Joust, like, either their careers tanked or their attempt to make a Joust movie tanked their careers. I don't know which one.
It's probably kind of a feedback loop.
Yes. All right, you want to talk about your game? I could go on about this failed movie.
Yeah. So I did R-Type, and R-Type is a side-scrolling shooter. You control the R9 Arrowhead spaceship to destroy the Baidu, or Baidu, however you pronounce it. They are a powerful alien race bent on wiping out all of mankind. R-Type started in the arcade. It was developed by IREM, who developed a bunch of fantastic games. And it, back then, the arcade cabinet was distributed by Nintendo in North America. There's a really cool, you know, Nintendo cabinet for this. But everyone really knows it from consoles. TurboGrafx-16, you know, kind of had the more popular one. I owned it back in the day. But there's also Master System and, you know, a few computer ports, I think. You know, you could get it on the Wii Virtual Console. And I think the 3DS. And this is just a beautiful, to me, almost flawless game. It has very, like, Aliens, H.R. Geiger-type artwork. It invented kind of this new mechanic where you have this orb in front of you that I think you were supposed to have, like, stolen or something from the aliens. It's called the Force. And it protects you like an invincibility shield in the front of you. You could also have it on the back of you if you want. And you could also shoot it off of you and send it, you know, far ahead of you, and it'll also keep shooting. So it's, you know, kind of adds this really cool dynamic to the game, because you need to know how to do that in certain spots to actually beat the game and not die. The bosses are huge and beautiful, and really every port of this, the graphics and the sound are just incredible. And I really can't say enough good things about this game. It brings back a lot of fantastic memories. I think everyone should play it at least once. I prefer the TurboGrafx-16 version. The original PC Engine one actually had two hue cards. I guess they couldn't sort out how to fit it on one, but the American one just comes on one. And I'm about to spoil the ending, so, you know, fast forward, you know, about a minute, starting, you know, in 3, 2, 1. But in the end, after you defeat everything, you know, kind of scrolls like, hey, we did it, you know, we beat, you know, the Baidu, and you saved the universe, yada, yada, yada. And then you see all different types of R9 ships flying with you, as if you were all doing it together, and it was just your viewpoint of your ship. So kind of a really cool thing to point out, that it was like a big battle, and you were just part of it. And I just thought that was really cool. So
what was that shooter we talked about that had the really crazy, bizarre ending? That Galaga 90, maybe?
Was it? Oh, man.
Yeah, you sent me a screenshot of the ending, and I'm like, what the heck?
Oh, what was that?
It was like, I think it was Galaga 90.
You're right. I think it was one port of Galaga 90.
Yeah, I was waiting for that here. I'm not very good at shooters, and R-Type, I typically play through like 1 to 2 stages, and then I say, that's it. So what did I put in my notes? If I can figure out which browser window I'm supposed to be looking at. So I tried the Master System version, which does look very good, but has really, really bad flicker. And then I tried both the TurboGrafx-16 and the CD versions. They seem pretty identical. The CD version has cutscenes and better music, but the actual
gameplay seems identical. I've never played that one.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, the gameplay seems identical otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they did any, like, extra colors or effects on the game itself, but there's a lot of cutscenes. And then, you know, Redbook audio. And usually I play through about 2 levels, and then I kind of get frustrated with it.
It's not easy, that's for sure.
No. Even getting through 2 levels is tough for me.
Yeah, same here. I mean, I beat it, you know, when I was a teenager, and I could barely get through two levels now. But it is, I just noticed, it is on the Switch and the PS4. So there is kind of a remake of it that I heard is great. I have not played it. And there are many sequels, and I heard they're all pretty good. Everyone seems to like the original the best, but there's not a lot of hate for the sequels either. So,
yeah.
What do you think you're going to play next?
I think I'm going to go with the back to school theme, and I'm going to play Super Dodgeball or any variant in the series. There's a lot of things all kind of called Dodgeball that are the same game. Sometimes they're Super Dodgeball, sometimes they're Downtown something Dodgeball.
Mm-hmm.
Just play Dodgeball.
What system do you think you're going to focus on?
Probably the probably the PC Engine CD version.
Very cool. I'm gonna focus on the Neo Geo version.
Okay.
And I'm gonna do ActRaiser simply because Super Nintendo, and I have not played it, geez, since middle school, something like that. So. Yeah, something like eighth grade. So, if any of our listeners, you know, play R-Type, Joust, ActRaiser, Super Dodgeball, any game we've listed, any retro game, have suggestions, have cool projects, funny stories, please, we want to hear from you. Email at retrogameclub.net. That is email at retrogameclub.net. We are on Facebook, thanks to Zach. Facebook.retrogameclub.net gets you right to our page. And at RGC Podcast. And we have a link tree in our notes that also has Instagram. I still don't know the Instagram name, but please, you know, go in the show notes, hit that link tree, and you'll see all of our, all the ways you could hit us up. And we got a few emails here.
Yeah. One of them, though, I'm going to save for. So Dale emailed us, and he sent us a question that I actually kind of want to do for a topic of our next episode. So. Dale, if you don't hear your email being read, that's why, because we're going to talk about it next time.
Yeah, it's going to be a whole topic.
Whole topic, yeah. So Joe writes in and said he's really happy to see some arcades opened up again, and he was able to play some of the games we talked about recently, like Donkey Kong in Commando, and being able to play the actual Spy Hunter arcade. He pointed out to his brother that you can see what power-up you get by looking at the icon on top of the van, and he did not realize that for over 30 years. He also mentions playing Pole Position on a Namco compilation, and also the arcade version, too. This guy who fixed up the cab he was playing mentioned that Pole Position hardware is often not worth fixing. So he puts the multi-game Pole Position emulation board in instead. I guess
I could see that.
Don't know the difference. And then he has a lot of love for R-Type and Super R-Type, saying it's his favorite shooting game. And Super R-Type was a game he bought when he bought his Super Nintendo. It was somewhat inexpensive at the time. And he also played the arcade version of Joust. You know, arcades are open, too. There you go.
Nice. And Stanley writes in, congrats on the 100 episodes, he says. In honor of the 90s, he took one of the episode games to the extreme and drove 2+ hours to play Joust.
Wow.
And, yeah, he says it's a game from the 80s, though. He played at Robot City Arcade and Game Store in Birmingham, New York. And let's see what else here. Joust is one of his early gaming memories, going back to probably 88, 89. He was 6 or 7. He just remembers, you know, playing them at local bowling alleys and stuff like that. It became a rental during sleepovers and... you know, they would play against each other, you know, before SNK or Capcom had, you know, any kind of, you know, fighting games like that. Joust was really an exceptional two-player game. I couldn't agree more, especially, yeah, on the NES and the 2600 as well. He couldn't even imagine playing this on an NES controller. Well, now he says.
Yeah.
He knows it definitely played great on the 2600. In 1993, actually remember liking it a lot more because of the joystick. Yeah, I think I could see that. Unfortunately, he didn't know of an arcade that had the R-Type cab. Maybe, you know, Galloping Ghost or something like that. Otherwise, it would be a lot of fun to play as well. And yeah, I'm sure it would. But like we said, like really the R-Type ports are as good as, you know, what you get on TurboGrafx or something. Like, yeah, the graphics are a little bit better, but you really won't notice. Mm-hmm. Stanley, thanks for letting me butcher your email.
And I will butcher the last email from Majors. Said he's very glad that you got your SSD3 hooked up, but then sounds like you might have some bent pins, but I think that's what you said that, right? Mm-hmm. But hopefully you can overcome it. He recently read that Amazon Japan is selling PC Engine minis for $75. Yeah, although although shipping may wipe out whatever you're saving versus buying it on eBay. yeah, looks like they are. Yeah, I've never tried to import from Amazon Japan before. Play Asia, I think I looked at, and I could not get one from there. Hmm. What else here? PS Portable, PS2 Portable hack. He mentions giving away 4 semi-working of the original, you know, wider PS2s to a friend to help with them with their attempt to make a portable PS2, but nothing came of it. I imagine not. Does your friend know anything about modding consoles? That's the first question.
Yeah.
Let's see. Sorry, skipping around here. R-Type. He was a big fan of R-Type. Played it a lot in 1988. He was mostly attracted to the space theme in music. He doesn't think he ever made it past stage 3 in the arcade. Plays it a lot on the Master System today, though. So it's one of his top 3 Master System games. Nice. And did get for the TurboGrafx 16, but there's so many other shooters to choose from on there that he ends up playing the Master System one more, it sounds like. TurboGrafx with messed up pins. He had a duo that one of the pins on the card slot got shoved back and snapped and was able to fix it with some very creative engineering. And I believe the cause was using a non-beveled third-party card. Huh. Yeah, like some kind of pirate card that isn't cut right.
Yeah.
Southern Fried Gaming Expo. So apparently that happened. Where does he say where that was? I guess it doesn't matter because it already happened. But this was the first year he could go, and he brought 27 cabinets and 8 consoles set up, and 8 consoles with CRTs.
That is a lot to bring.
He brought 10% of the arcade machines there, if I'm doing my math here.
Yeah.
So there were 300 machines total. The console area was in a separate breakout room. They had over 30 setups ranging from Atari Stun Cycle to a PlayStation 4. And they had a very large open area with tables for board and card games. And they teamed up with the Vintage Computer Festival Southeast also. And it was particularly fun to see a lot of those old computers hooked up. And they sent us some photos, which, if they're okay to share on the Instagram or anything, or Twitter, we should share a couple of these.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I'm looking, actually, I'm looking at some of the photos right now. There's a Discs of Tron, which is one of my favorite cabinets ever. There's a Blaster, which is like, this was like a really late, like this Blaster to me is a like arcade crash game. You know, it was sort of a late release. It is such a trip. Have you played Blaster? Do we do that as a game?
Is that the one where you get like the gun on top of your roof of your car? Or is that Road Blaster?
No, that's Road Blaster. Blaster is this weird space game where it's super trippy and there's like astronauts you have to save while shooting stuff.
Okay, we have to... That sounds like Mad Planets, but I know it's not.
It's not Mad Planets. No, it's not. No.
It needs to be a Game Club game.
Yeah, we'll have to talk about Blaster if we haven't done that.
All right. Thank you all for those emails. We got some social media. Some people write in about the SNES turning 30. Just, you know, so many classic titles. Someone writes in saying Mortal Kombat 2 on the Super NES was the first and only pre-order that mattered. What else? For Game Club games, someone writes in, both Game Club picks have a lot of good ports. I used to play on the Apple II port of Joust, which I didn't even know existed. R-Type is one of his all-time favorites. Probably the SNES port was played the most, which, again, I did not get a chance to play that one. But he also mentions the ZX Spectrum, C64, and MSX. Again, all ports we didn't talk about.
Oh, yeah, I was telling you. I mean, Apple II, that's the thing. Like, I believe every game is important to Apple II from the era.
Yeah.
I mean, every game released between, like, 1979 and 1986 probably has an Apple II port.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not counting stuff that's, like, a Nintendo license, and even some Nintendo license stuff got ported.
Yeah, like the original Mario Brothers, I'm pretty sure, is on
there. Yeah, Donkey Kong's on there for sure, too. Mm-hmm. Basically, anything up until the NES is probably ported to, to Apple II. It's just everything. Sometimes more than one. I mean, the way licensing worked, some of those games have more than one port.
Yeah. What else do we got? Someone writes in, never got an R-Type. He likes Gradius a little bit better. And played the 2600 port of Joust an awful lot as a kid. He just has a special place in his heart. Someone else remembers playing Joust on many formats, arcade, C64, ColecoVision, and probably some more. Definitely had a lot of fun with it. It's definitely a quarter muncher, like Gauntlet or X-Men, and that is for sure.
Yeah, I think Joust in the arcade, you pretty much have to play free play.
Yeah. What else do we have? Something you believed about a video game that turned out to be wrong. And someone writes in, that mist is fun.
I'm trying to think of, was this a question I asked on the show once?
It was either you or Zach.
Okay. Well, maybe I asked it and Zach remembered that I asked it. Something you believed about a game that turned out to be wrong. Wonder what that was about. Has to be something I brought up.
I cannot remember. And then we had some news about the A500 Mini, which is the Amiga 500 Mini that's coming out. And someone writes in that in 1988, he saved up some money and got an Amiga 500 with a monitor, a color printer, a 512K expansion, and he got a VCR as well thrown into it. Yeah, that's pretty awesome. He had GSOS on it, or GOS, which, you know, was the graphical interface. And he kept the C64 to play some Ultima 5, which on GOG, I have all the Ultima games. And if I ever get that Steam Deck, I think Ultima is going to be the first thing I play on it. Well, all right. That is all our social media and other feedback. So again, please, everyone, even though we butcher your emails, we love reading them. Mm-hmm. And we hope you like us butchering them. So please email us at email@retrogameclub.net. And I think that wraps her up.
Yeah, I think so. So thanks for listening.
Yeah, thank you.